All right, so what we're trying to do is figure out how to do an intro. Go.
Well, this is my first question is, do we want to try and emulate other podcasts that we like?
Hey, welcome to Smartless.
Ready? This is here are some of the things that were on my mind that I thought we should talk about. What I think is a great thing that we should be regularly trying to think of are where each of us individually or together show up in other people's stories that you know they're talking about in some way, shape, or form. And here's my example that just popped into my head when Carrie and I were talking about some stuff a while ago. So I have major dental issues. I've always had dental issues. We know this. We know this.
What are you doing, Eric?
Dental work. When the teeth fall out, you got to put them back in.
I've got three implants at this point. I've had a bridge. I've had my teeth have always been a mess. And I only say that because before all of the issues really started, this was 20 plus years ago. I think I was at U of M at the time. And I scheduled a doctor's appointment for cleaning at the dentist that I grew up in, going to, right? Whatever, the whole thing. And I'm in there for the cleaning, and the hygienist or whatever they're called that's in there that's doing the cleaning, she's like, oh, you've got something in your, you got something stuck in your gum. And I was like, oh. And so she starts digging at it, right? And all of a sudden, simultaneously, I feel something large hit the back of my throat, and she goes, oh, literally verbally made a sound associated with, and it was apparently such a big chunk of my lunch from that day.
Jesus Christ, that was, Eric.
That was stuck in my gums.
I'm seriously going to puke.
I don't know exactly. That was another topic about your gag reflex. So she made some kind of comment Jesus, or something whatever. She's like, you clearly need to floss more, or something along those lines. I say all that because it was very clear. It was a very unique situation for her. And I'm sure to this day, she's still talking about this gigantic chunk of food that got pried out of somebody's gums.
I can't imagine she's still talking about that. What do you think? Christmas story? Hey, kids, gather around. Let me tell you about the time.
What's some of the craziest shit you've seen as a dental hygienist?
But here's...
That was really an example of other situations. Because I guarantee you, there's stuff that you've done that people remember.
Yes. No, I like the concept. I like the concept of what stories are you in, or what do you think? Case in point is this. Dale, our friend Dale, you've been harboring, when you played the prank on him that his girlfriend was cheating on him. You've been harboring that forever. And then when you finally brought it up to him, a couple months ago, he's like, I don't even remember that. So you think you're in his story and he doesn't even remember it.
Fair.
So I like the concept of what stories do you think that you're in? I mean, obviously there's the big ones and
What? What just came to mind?
Man, I'd have to really think about that. I mean, there's things like at basketball camp when we locked that guy. We locked him in the bedroom. He was in the bedroom.
Yeah.
This was at Grand Valley State in Michigan.
Saginaw Valley,
yeah. So yeah. He was in the room. We were must have been juniors, right? And he was a senior.
Yep.
And we put him in the room.
We didn't put him in the room. He was in the room napping. So when we
sleeping, yeah.
Yeah, he was sleeping, and it was I don't think it was the morning. I think it was the afternoon, because we got up super early and played and then came back and everybody crashed and we had some in between time. And
yeah.
Had gone into his room. We had the shared suite scenario, so they're four bedrooms off of the main area, which was their dorm setup.
So yeah, so we took all the furniture and just piled it up.
So from our rooms and from the main area, the goal was actually we stacked it so that when he opened his door, because he had to open it inward, that all the furniture would fall into his room.
Oh my God. That was your engineering there, I guarantee it. Well, if we do this,
I'm not going to say I didn't try to work on it, but it got to be time. I don't know if you remember this. It got to be time to go back to, I don't know if we were going to lunch or we were going back to play ball again. But we were like, it's time to go, and like beat on his door. It's like, time to get right, out of door. Right. We beat on the door and we all split. And I think some of us ran out the door. Others went into our rooms and
because we put like water and stuff on there too.
Stacked like water jugs that were open, that were like whatever. And so we're like, gotta go. And then we all like scattered. And then all of a sudden you just hear furniture being thrown. It's like, God damn it. You just hear like yelling and furniture clearly being thrown and shit after it all fell. And the whole reason that we did this was had decided that he was going to be a leader of the team, self-appointed. And he was trying to care. I know what he was trying to do. He was trying to carry
guarantee over. Someone was like, lead your way out of this room.
What? Yeah, by someone, it was you or me, probably.
It sounds like something I would say.
So, but he just, it was like, A, again, it was self-appointed. B, it was just like, he was trying to be like super intense and like yelling at people and like, you know, this is what you need to be doing. And like trying to just like take over the team. And he wasn't the best player in the team.
Did he even make the team?
No, he didn't. No, he did not. But he quit after that.
Oh, because we locked him in the bedroom? Okay. This is a good episode to talk about our guest, because we can go through some basketball memories, but our guest today is going to be my business partner, Chip Reeves. You have not met him, so I'm actually excited for you to meet him.
Yeah.
He does the sports side. I mean, he does a lot of different things at our company, but he's really kind of known for the sports side of our company. So he did 30 for 30s, the Game of the Century, did the doc on that. What's interesting to me is he started working at ESPN in 95, which is right around the time you and I mean, we were watching ESPN. Oh, not you, right, because you didn't have cable.
Correct.
You weren't allowed to have cable. But regardless, so he worked at ESPN during those that time period. So I'm interested. It's funny, I've never talked to him about this. There's so many things that like I don't even know about him.
Ebb and flow, here we go.
Hey guys.
Chip Reeves.
What's happening?
If I had to bet what hat you were wearing, God, I should have called it like what you were wearing.
Well, I'm kind of stating the obvious, aren't we?
I guess.
Does this sound okay? The microphone's a little bit far from me, but does it sound okay?
It sounds a little far.
Okay. Let me reconfigure where I am. Give me 1 minute to reconfigure this. I'm going to switch rooms.
Cool.
All right, cool. I guarantee he's frustrated. See, that's him being frustrated.
He's angry right now.
That's he's so angry. That's his. He is. He's a 10 out of 10 anger. It's the angriest I've ever seen that guy.
Just Bobby Knight throwing chairs.
I am excited to have Chip on. I actually am really excited to have him on. So the weird thing about having business partners in this is like, I was a fan of his before working with him. And like, so then when I got there, I was like, all right, let me play it cool. You know,
I've seen you try and play it cool.
It's not good. I have no coolness to me. None. And there was a point that turned, I used to think I was a cool cat, like just a hip guy. all right, here's Mr. Chip Reeves.
Okay. So sorry guys, this is going to be better for all of us.
Do you want us to send you some, either Detroit Lions swag probably, or Miami Dolphins?
Yeah, just whatever loser teams you can possibly find, you can send my way.
The merch is really cheap.
Discounted. Everything must go. Are we on? Are we doing this right now? Or are we going to?
No, we're good. We are flying. This is it.
Okay, so I'm just looking at my, let me see where my framing is. Okay, you know, I have a little bit of vanity, right?
A little bit. I was telling you, the intro was, we're going to have the vainest person on.
That's not true. David is much more vain than I am.
The intro was that it's weird having a business partner on because there's certain things about you I probably should know.
Yeah.
We have never talked about the ESPN years. Yeah. And Eric and I both were like, ESPN was all we would watch.
Yeah.
A certain point of our lives, that was it. And you were there.
Yeah, I mean, me too. So, you know, I graduated from college, and like a lot of us, I was just going to, you know, dream job was going to ESPN. And I graduated in 1995, and like a couple months after graduation, there I was in Bristol, freaking Connecticut, in the middle of nowhere, working at ESPN.
Wait.
Yeah, you just skipped over all sorts of stuff.
You went to, this is when you went to UT.
Yeah. I don't have a bunch of degrees on the wall. There's only one degree. There's no master's, there's no doctorate, University of Texas.
That's even better. So, but what did you go to school for, and did it translate directly to going to ESPN?
Yeah. So I studied broadcast journalism. So I was supposed to be a stockbroker. And my dad, my grandfather, everybody was stockbrokers. And I was just like, can we cuss?
Yes.
I was like, fuck that. You know, I'm going to carve my own path. So I was a writer first, sports editor for the paper. I did the morning announcements at my high school. I didn't have a radio show in high school, but I had a radio show in college and was a broadcast journalism major. And then midway through college in 1992, a friend of our family's was working at NBC Sports and needed to have an intern in New York for the Barcelona Olympics. And so I left college in 1992.
The 92 Dream Team Olympics.
Yeah, I was there at the gold medal match for the Dream Team. I saw all kinds of shit.
Oh, my gosh.
Hung out with OJ. All kinds of stuff. Yeah, so I did that. So I took 9 months off of school, went to New York, went to Barcelona, and then came back and finished school. And so by the time I had done that, you know, I had a pretty good resume for a college kid. And so I was still doing internships. And so fast forward to when I graduated from college, I got a job pretty soon thereafter. And I moved from, you know, like Valhalla, you know, in Austin, Texas, to no disrespect to anybody from Bristol, but moving from Austin, Texas to Bristol, Connecticut, when you're like 23 years old is a pretty big culture shock. Believe me when I tell you. And that's what I did.
Yeah. What is Bristol like? It's small town or?
There's wonderful people there. It's neat, but it's
no, not, yeah, I'm not asking you to shit on it. I'm just saying like, all I know of Bristol is ESPN.
It's a pretty rugged place. Like if you've ever seen the Aaron Hernandez documentaries, Aaron Hernandez grew up in Bristol. I mean, that's not necessarily like, you know, Aaron Hernandez's world is not a microcosm of Bristol, Connecticut. But Bristol is, you know, it's a blue collar place. I mean, there's a lot of people will tell you that it's in the middle of nowhere, Connecticut. And the reason why ESPN started there is because land was cheap and they just like, here's where we're going to start this TV network. And we're going to start televising like Big East basketball and Hartford Whalers games. So there wasn't like this big agenda to make this thriving, you know, metropolis, that it's become today. And I'm not talking about Bristol. I'm just talking about the ESPN campus. But I'll tell you this, that the cool thing about being in Bristol at the time was, you know, you kind of form this like band of brothers mentality. So you're just all you have is your people and your friends and your teams. And so that was pretty neat. I mean, the friendships that I made when I got there, you know, are people that I still talk to today.
What are you doing there at that when you first got there?
I mean, I was a PA, obviously. And so I started working in college football, like putting graphics reels together and clip reels together. And then I moved over to doing other stuff. Like I worked on hockey. I didn't know shit about hockey. And they were like, are you sure?
Same.
I'm like, I still don't. But I I was willing to learn. I think I still know what a blue line is today.
Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, it makes one of us.
So that was kind of the neat thing about ESPN at the time. Like, I worked on hockey. I worked on Formula One racing. I worked on the Winter X Games. And then I did the other stuff like college basketball, college football.
When you're saying you're doing these, like, what does that entail? Is that you're actually going to the games, or you're at the studio cutting them?
Yeah. So most of the time I was there, I was working on I was supporting the remote production game. So I was getting graphic elements together. I was getting tease elements together for the truck. So I was like the guy on the ground that could help service the production in the field. And then on the weekends or at night, we'd be in a tape room on a Saturday and the touchdown in the Michigan State, Penn State game happens. And so we get on, the comms and tell.
It was definitely Penn State scoring that.
We've got a touchdown. And we would literally, it was like old school, like 1-inch tape, like old school tape. We'd re-rack the tape and we'd be like, tape two is ready with, the Lorenzo White touchdown, whatever, whoever it was. And then we'd roll that in and then we'd go back to the game. So, I was a grunt, man. I was like, bottom of the totem pole.
Okay, I've got a ton of questions, and Rick's going to keep interrupting, so I'm going to throw some in here. Your reference to 1-inch tape, was that like open reel to reel that you were working on?
Yeah, we were just recording, so we would have like these different procs. So we'd take the feeds in from wherever they were, and you were recording the games on 1-inch tape. So it's just, that's just what they had. And so in 1995 and 96,
cutting edge.
There, exactly.
Can we jump back real quick? And then, and Rick, whatever you're going to ask, we'll jump back into this timeline.
We can't.
I'm really curious about your reference to, I was supposed to be a stockbroker, right? But then you ended up going to school for broadcast.
Yeah.
Was there a point before you went to school that you like made that conscious decision of, this is something I really want to do? Or is it something you were trying to go to school for, figure out if you wanted to do it? And at what point did you go, yeah, I'm definitely going to do this?
Yeah, I think... Even if, good question, Eric.
Don't feed his ego.
Shut up. Let him talk.
Maybe I'm a bit of a contrarian. Like, I just don't. I don't know. Just, I'm not a follower, I guess. So I probably didn't want to do exactly what my dad and my grandfather did. My real name is Claude Green Reeves V. And by the way, I love my dad, and rest in peace, my grandfather. I loved him too. But I'm the fifth. And Claude Green Reeves III was a stockbroker. Claude Green Reeves IV was a stockbroker. And so I was like, there's no fucking way I'm going to be a stockbroker. I don't know why. It was just something in my head, probably. I mean, and then I gravitated to sports as a kid. I loved sports, but I was like, holy shit, I'm not good at sports. Like, not only am I not good, I'm really, really bad. So I got to figure out a way to stay in the game without playing in the game. So like, I used to announce Little League baseball games when I was in high school. Oh, wow. And like, I did all kinds of shit. And like I said, I did the morning announcements at school, and I would like, have fun with that. And so I think I figured that there was a path to being in the game without being on the field. And so when I was looking at colleges, all the colleges I looked at were journalism schools, and it just so happened that UT had a good journalism school. I grew up in Houston, see? Yeah. And so, UT was just like a natural fit.
Do you have a lot of...
All right, shut up. I got a question.
Wait, just on that one. Oh, wait. Do you have like recordings of the radio shows and stuff you referenced when you were there in college? Do you ever revisit that stuff just for fun?
So no... No, I don't revisit them for fun. And yes, they exist somewhere.
Oh.
There it is.
It is my mission now to find those and play them at the Christmas party.
Your camera is so clean, Rick. I mean, everything looks so great in your background. I mean,
yeah, it's at the house that you refuse to come to, so that's fun. My business partner won't come to
my
house.
You don't invite me. You invite all the kids.
Oh, my God. All right, let's go back to ESPN. And I want to get to your defining moment in a second here, but who were the big names at ESPN? Was that during the like Dan Patrick era.
Yeah, Olbermann, Dan Patrick.
Was Craig Kilborn there?
Kilborn was there. Yeah. So this is a great story. So we're working on college basketball. And this, bear in mind, this is probably 1997. So imagine how, like, in 1997, I thought Dick Vitale was 80 years old. He's still working. So we're working on college basketball, and we're in this, and it was a tournament. And so it's we're watching all the games. And one of the researchers asks if he can bring his little brother up to just kind of be a fly on the wall. And the little brother walks in. And there's this production meeting, and Vitale, in the middle of the games, is like just completely racked out, like sitting there snoring, not watching any of the games, and then like 20 minutes later, like, you know, and Dick Vitale is a hero. I love Dick Vitale, so no disrespect to Dick Vitale. Sorry for revealing this story, Dickie V. It's like 20 minutes later, you know, that same researcher whose little brother is now mortified because he's seeing his idol, like, literally asleep on the job, hands Dickie V a card with some stats in there, and Dickie V starts blowing, "Oh, baby, it was beautiful." About how awesome the game was, and he didn't watch a second of it. It's so great. Another really, really, really good story is... When I was talking about like this band of brothers that we had, and you know, we were still like, you're still a little bit intimidated when Chris Berman walks in the room or something like that. And they were like, you know, like, I mean, back then, like, to be very candid, the term snowflake or like any of this like didn't exist. There was a lot of yelling and screaming, and like there was this whole Bobby Knight mentality. It's just like, shut the fuck up and do your job and deal with it. And if you don't do your job, you can go home and somebody else will come in here and do your job for you.
Yeah.
Pretty simple.
Yeah. Old school.
Yeah. And so we all appreciate it. So we're in line, and we're in line getting pizza. That was the best part of working on the weekends, is you got two meals, like kind of like prison. You got two squares. So we're in line, and we're standing in line, and my buddy's like, he's like, "Man, I really fucked up teleprompter." He's like, "Yeah, I was doing the prompter, and I was all off, and I could tell Berman was getting pissed." And he's like, "God damn!" I was like, he was like all nervous, and so we're standing in line, and Chris Berman walks in, and we're just standing, and fucking Berman doesn't know who the hell's running prompter, and so the producer was like, "Hey, Boomer, how was the show?" He's like, "Oh, you know, everything was great." He's like, "But who the fuck was on prompter?" He's like, "God damn it, that guy was..." It turns out my buddy Scott is like standing right by them. He's just like standing there like this, like, "I'm going to get fired." The head of the network is yelling at me and criticizing me. It's pretty funny.
Hey, Chip, do you have a favorite sports moment? I want to know two of them. Your favorite sports moment, because you always go to the World Series every time Houston cheats. And then is there a ESPN favorite sports moment?
Well, what do you mean by ESPN favorite sports moment?
Like for me, one of the coolest things I ever got to do, like, I was a Tim Hardaway fan growing up, Dan Marley fan, and when I moved to Miami, the camera guy that gave me my start, we would go into the locker rooms. And just being on the floor during the Heat Knicks series, God, this was the early 2000s, like, just being on the floor, coming from a small town in Michigan, you pinch yourself and go, "Holy cow, like, how did I get here? This is the most amazing thing." And I was a grunt, you know, but it still was one of the coolest things. And then going in the locker room and seeing those guys in the locker rooms was amazing.
So I'm trying to think. I mean, you know, I also spent 7 years with the NFL Network. So I was in different locker rooms every Sunday. I didn't know that.
These are the things that I probably should know about you.
You should have done your research, Rick. It's on LinkedIn.
Do you have a moment or a couple of moments of the most nervous you ever got during?
Great question.
So yeah, I mean that's really like a really important thing with my entire career, and that is live TV like totally stressed me out, like unnecessarily stressed me out. Like I was talking about being in the control room and re-racking those things, like it was like not gratifying. So, you know, all these, you know, a lot of my colleagues would walk out of the remote truck or the studio and like high-fiving and just like, that was awesome. And I'd be like, it was tough. It was really tough. Yeah. So I realized that's not where I should be. And so I did a pretty big pivot in my career, and I switched over to doing long form storytelling. I just kind of stumbled into it with a series called Sports Century and the 50 Greatest Athletes. And that's like, it like totally changed the arc of my professional life, really.
Wow. Is that your defining moment?
Look at you, how excited you are asking the defining moment question.
Yeah, look, I got the name of the show in the question. I learned from you, Chip.
Yeah. So the thing that really changed my entire career was Secretary at the Horse. So I was working on this series, the 50 Greatest Athletes of the Century, and they divided the 50 athletes into different pods. We worked on this for a couple of years, and so we each had 7 athletes, and I had like Willie Mays, Wilt Chamberlain, Joe Montana, Jack Nicklaus, Mark Spitz, Eric Heiden, and Bill Tilden, tennis player, and Secretariat, the horse. And when they revealed Secretariat as the 35th greatest athlete of the century, it got a lot of eyeballs. It was like very, very, very controversial. And because it was so controversial, everybody watched, right? And I got to really get in the chair, write, produce, do a bunch of interviews for it. Like I had my fingerprints all over that piece as an AP at the time. And because of that piece, I got a lot of credibility internally and externally. And we won an award. We won an Eclipse Award for horse racing. And I didn't know shit about horse racing. Just like the hockey story earlier, like, you know, I didn't even know what a freaking furlong was or any of that kind of stuff. But I learned the world of horse racing. And then I did all these horse racing documentaries for like 3 years. Like, Seabiscuit, Citation, Affirmed. I did all these horse racing documentaries. But yeah, so Secretariat, like, totally changed my career. And then it gave me some street cred to be like a documentary producer director. And here I am today.
That's a great story. I certainly had no idea.
I will say this, when you see some of the movies and some of the other stuff, they rip off a lot of things that we gave them a long time ago.
Those thieves.
I know.
No royalty checks for you?
No royalties. No.
I think it's really interesting that's the second or third time you've referenced your willingness to put yourself out there and work on something that you really don't know anything about.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it was by design or just serendipity or what. Like, you know, I do think that we all have to be aware of luck in our lives, but, you know, luck is when preparation meets opportunity, right? So
for sure.
You just have to be aware that you're in a certain place at a certain time, and there's a reason for that. And I'm not trying to get spiritual or deep or anything like that, but I think you have to recognize your fortune and just make sure you don't fuck it up.
So what made me nervous about you, Chip?
My striking good looks.
He wouldn't stop talking about it before you got on.
That smile.
I do get that a lot, so I understand.
Yeah. I got it. So when we started working with you, this was before we merged our company or you did that hostile takeover of our company. You were working on Five Slammajama at the time. And you have to understand, there were no bigger basketball fans in the world than Eric and I.
Besides me.
No. I you're third. So Clyde Drexler and Hakeem Olajuwon were the gold standard. Jordan, all those people. Like it was debatable if Olajuwon's the best center of all time.
Not debatable. There's no debate.
You don't think Shaq?
Fuck no. Nope.
Okay.
Ask Shaq.
Yeah, Shaq will say he's the best. Shaq will say, like, you put me and Kobe together. And
Shaq will tell you a team's the best.
He said it. He doesn't believe it. Whatever. We'll get to that in a second. So, I was doing the Obama doc, and you were doing Fi Slama Jama. You were directing. I think it was that.
First of all, let's talk about that for a second. Like, how amazing is that? That at the same time we're doing a 30 for 30 and a freaking documentary about the President of the United States, narrated by John Legend.
To that, you got to interview Clyde Drexler, Hakeem Olajuwon, and it was phenomenal. And you're just like, yeah, whatever. Well, there's no question there. I was just telling you how cool that was.
Look, I mean, the reality is, so that was five whatever years ago. So I was maturer then than I, you know, than I was. So if I had done that in my earlier career, I would have been nervous and I would have been, you know, a fanboy probably. But by that time, like, I, you know, like, there really hadn't been any athlete that I hadn't been around, right? Like, you know, I'd been around Jordan. I hadn't been around Bird and Magic and Montana and Tom Brady and Peyton Manning and Earl Campbell, who was my childhood hero. Nolan Ryan, who was my childhood hero. Like, my password forever, when you first got passwords, my password was always Hakeem 34. and so he was my guy. And so I flew. This is actually a pretty good story. So, and you might not even know this, Rick. So we get the contract, and all these things are fucking so difficult. They're just always so difficult, Eric. You know.
Wait, is this the Fi Slama Jama?
Rick probably tells you, but you just have no idea how difficult every.
Okay, but yeah, start. I want to start from the beginning of that. Like, how did that even come about?
I'm talking about all of them.
All right. Stop yelling.
I'm going there. So we pitch, you know, so I go to New York and I'm pitching things and like a lot of these things, you know, you go in with this agenda and then they're like, yeah, fuck that. No. And saying, do you have anything for college basketball? I was like, I could repitch you Fi Slama Jama that I pitched you 18 times to Sunday. And they're like, well, let's hear that again. And they're like, huh. We need a college basketball doc. And I'm like, well, here it is. So they're like, okay, we'll do it. One caveat, you have to have Hakeem and Clyde participate. No problem. Can you get him? Of course. No problem. We get him. No problem. Yeah. So I start working the phone, like, fuck, you know, who are we going to get? How can we get him? So I love Clyde. But Clyde is a very polished, professional person. And so I go, Clyde, you know, what are we going to do? He's like, well, you know, ESPN, Jordan, and blah, 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 and da, da, da. Like, so he's like, I don't know. I'm like, what the fuck?
He's going back and forth because of Jordan, because of how much ESPN?
I don't know. He's just, you know, everybody can be a little more difficult than they should be, right?
No, I understand that, but I know that he's got a major thing with Jordan.
You know, people are gun shy about Doc, as well they should be, about Docs, and maybe he's been burned by ESPN in the past. You know, that a lot of these guys are, I'm not saying that Clyde's that way, but a lot of these guys are very thin skinned, and who the hell knows? So anyway, so we're getting all this stuff together, but we can't get a payment until we can show them signed release from Clyde Drexler and Hakeem Olajuwon. And so we're starting to run out of time. So I finally get to Clyde, and he's like, look. He's like, if you can get Hakeem to do it, I'll do it. So I just assume Hakeem is down the road in Houston. We're in Austin. I'll drive 2.5 hours. Hakeem is outside of London in a town called Birmingham. So I get on a plane, fly to England, go meet Hakeem, and my entire thing rests on interviewing Hakeem, because once I get Hakeem, Clyde will do. But now I haven't really had a chance to think about like fanboying out with Akeem because I'm so caught up into the business of it all. I've got to get Akeem in the chair. We've got to do this interview. If I don't get Akeem to do the interview, I can't get Clyde, and my dream documentary will not get made. So it wasn't until the morning of when I realized this can happen, like, shit, are you going to be nervous when interviewing your hero? And I wasn't. And so for me, like, doing that interview, like, was a testament to myself, like, okay, I'm actually a legitimate professional and I can do things like a professional would without bias or anything. So what's the show called again?
Mind. Moments and Memories.
That could have been one of my defining moments. I just realized it. There you go.
Nice. Look at that. Played out as we speak.
You were going to London to interview him or to try and get him on board?
No. I mean, we had it all lined up. We had it all lined up. Yeah.
For Rick's mom, give us the 15-second pitch of what the project is, the Phi Slamma Jamma.
Yeah, so Phi Slamma Jamma was a 30 for 30 about the greatest team that you've never heard of. Went to 3 Final Fours, lost to 3 incredible teams, and never got a ring. Came oh so close, but is only now forever remembered as the team that lost to Jim Valvano in that crazy play in 1983.
When did you first meet Steve Michaels?
In Connecticut, when I was working on the secretariat thing at Sports Century. Yeah, so Steve...
What was he doing?
He was working on it too. So Steve was above me, but we were kind of peers.
Things haven't changed.
Right. I mean, he wasn't as far above me as he is now. But I can say without hesitation that I liked Steve. Steve, I liked you then.
And he's not listening to this.
For sure is not going to listen to that. So, but I'll tell you this. This is another good defining moment. Steve called me. So Steve, when he left, he went with Fox Sports. And at the time, ESPN and Fox Sports were very bitter rivals. Yeah. Like, you for sure couldn't work for both. Steve called me and asked me if I would go work on his new series he's working on, Beyond the Glory. And
Brad worked on that.
Yeah, he did. And so I called one of my mentors at ESPN, a guy named Bud Morgan, wonderful human being, and very influential in my life, by the way. And I called Bud and I said, what do? I'm a freelancer. Like, you know, I could use the money and I could use the new contacts. And he said, my advice to you is not to go work with Steve in Fox Sports. It wasn't about Steve, it was about Fox. I was like, why? He's like, you're going to burn a bridge. And I was like, well, that fucking sucks. Like, why can't I do both? And at the time, you just couldn't. I remember when
Coke and Pepsi,
when people would leave ESPN, when Fox was first starting and doing all their stuff, if somebody found out they took a job with ESPN, at Fox, it didn't matter how long they had been at ESPN, how loyal, how much blood, sweat, and tears they had given, clean out your desk now. It was like immediate. Like security would come in and there'd be like, you know, banker's boxes standing there. I saw it happen a few times. Like, holy shit, this is real.
Can we talk about Wishbone?
I don't care. I mean, how many viewers do y'all have?
Right now? Well, goose egg.
We have to release the content in order to have viewers.
I don't give a shit. We can talk about it.
So how did that come about?
So, wow. All full circle. So another person that I was working with when I was doing the secretariat thing is John Dahl, who's become like, you know, a big wig at ESPN Films, one of the creators of 30 for 30. And so John and I have been friends, you know, for a long time. And we've done all of our 30 for 30s through John. And anyway, when Texas and Oklahoma were moving to the SEC, they had reached out to me saying, look, we could use some ideas. We need, this is good for us, Rick. We could use some local production companies who understand the culture of these teams in this conference. We have these East Coast production companies who are trying to tell a story like about Mississippi State, and they don't get it. And it looks bad. The optics are not good. So he's like, pitch us some bunch of ideas. And so we did. Of course, they didn't take any of the ideas. And they called me back and said, would you be willing to do a story on the history of the wishbone and how the wishbone offense revolutionized college football? And back to your point, Eric, the answer is always yes. Like, you can do anything. So, yeah. Hell yeah. So, yeah. So we're.
Do you want Ghost in there? We can do that too.
Speaking of authenticity.
Yeah. Speaking of authenticity, jump scares. I got a few of those.
Yeah. All right. But go back to the wishbone. It's an hour long, right?
Yeah. Just like this podcast. And,
yeah, we're going to cut it down to 7 minutes.
Yeah.
So
this is fucking gold, man. Come on. I'm giving you all kinds of stuff. You're peeling back the onion of my brain, talking about my youth.
I got one for you.
Crazy.
Go ahead.
You've been in the industry for a while, and I think, like...
Screw you, Eric.
No, we're all relatively the same age, but I think it's really cool that, like, the era that we've grown up through, right... even just talking about like computer technology, internet, all that kind of stuff, but from the AV technology as well, it would be really interesting to hear any of your take about like that evolution of the technology, right? You just talked about working on 1-inch tape, like reels, yeah. Right? To where we're at now and the way, and the things that we can do from now. Like, is that the kind of thing, do you remember any like memorable moments, like from the technology side that you're like, oh shit, we can
yeah.
do that now?
Yeah. Or, yeah. Like, non-linear editing. Non-linear yeah. editing. Like, yeah. I mean, like, wait, you mean we can just get a bunch of sound bites, put them in a computer, and then move them around as we want? And for somebody like me, which Rick can attest to, who's not always the most prepared when he gets into an edit, it was great. It didn't save us any money because we were wasting time and money moving shit around. But like, you know, where I started from, you had to like line up your edit and you had to screen the B-roll and screen the bites and make sure every shot was lined up. And you had to be uber prepared before you walked into the edit because you only had like a couple of hours of edit time. And then you just had to chop, chop, chop. You had to get in there. Like, it was a big deal if you could get into they called it a 9-10 room. So you could do dissolves. Like, you were like special if you get in a 9-10 room because you could do dissolves rather than just cuts. So when I got into a space where we had non-linear editing, it was just like, psh, holy wow. shit.
I know, these kids can do that on their phone now.
Right. Yeah. And now it's the kind of thing that nobody can actually appreciate any of that anymore, right? Like, and same thing happened with audio going from, you know, 2-inch tape to, you know, into the yeah. DAW. You know, type stuff that, but no one can appreciate.
Yeah, but what I will say, and I think Rick, you'll for sure agree with this. I do try, and I don't try. I make sure that there is at least a script ready to go. It is not fair to the creative process.
Well, there's words on the paper for sure.
Yeah, and then you can go from there. But like, there's too many times when people think that, and they still do it. Like, you just take, you go shoot a bunch of footage and you have like an idea and you just dump it into the lap of an editor. And it's not the way the process should work.
I'm going to make a comment to that point, cause I've said this to a lot of people along the way. And you just mentioned, Chip, about Rick being like the best in the business. The thing
that's really no bullshit. Like, all of this.
No, listen, I'm gonna back.
That is legit.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna back what you're saying right now. So I've worked with Rick. I've known him from the get go, from the whole thing. And at every stage in his career along the way, everyone that has ever worked with him has tried to keep him. Like, I watched it happen on multiple times, and multiple levels.
Brad was the lucky one. He was the winner. He kept me.
Because of exactly what you were talking about, which is that ability for somebody to just be able to throw a bunch of shit at him and go, make a story out of this. Or like, what is this? I think it's supposed to be this. But actually being able to piece everything together, see all the pieces and parts, and make it happen and come out into something good is something that I've never seen somebody do it as well as Rick.
So I'll say this, because I don't like all this talk, but I'll say this about this. Selling is so difficult because you can make something good, but it doesn't mean it's sellable. And that's something that it, like, it doesn't matter how good you are at anything. If it doesn't fit the network's needs, like Chip, you're talking about all these ideas you pitched to ESPN. How many times do we have a great meeting like, oh, there's a chance that they'll pick this up, and they just don't?
It's a terrible industry.
I
have gratitude, I really do, but like it's a thankless and unforgiving industry, and like if me or Rick or anybody else aren't doing something right now and moving the ball forward and being active, no one gives a shit about what anybody has accomplished in the past.
Kinda.
It gets you in the room.
It gets you in the room, but it's also a calling card. Like when we say like, oh yeah, we do. And I always lead with, because when someone finds out what we do, it's like, oh, anything I've heard of. I always say, well, the thing that would help me answer that question is, what are you into? Do you like true crime? Do you like sports stocks? Do you like this? And the thing that inherently everyone's always heard of is the 30 for 30s. Just, and whether they've seen them, they just know about them. So that's always a lead out thing. So now I think that gets us the quality of it, and the promotion and stuff gets you to, like you said, in the room. Doesn't make it that they're going to buy it, but it gives you the legitimacy to keep getting in those rooms.
Yeah. I mean, they matter. And like, I just, I had a conversation, we did the Field of Dreams documentary for Fox Sports, and I can call the head of Fox Sports and talk to him about an idea. I don't have to like set up a pitch meeting. I can do those things, and that's, so I shouldn't be dismissive of the background. You're right, but it's just like, it's a beatdown. I mean, I don't know how David does it. I don't know how he does it over and over and over again, and just gets beaten down with these great ideas. And in our business, if you're batting 200. You're great. If you're batting 300, you're an all-star, So it's whatever.
Yeah. All right. Two more questions. I promise. These are the last two, and then we'll let you go.
Two more questions, like 18 questions.
Because you keep saying things, and then it spawns this. What do your kids think about what you do? Do they care?
So this is funny. So for a long time, they didn't know what the hell I did. I was gone for like every weekend for like 7 years, from September to January, I was gone. And then I traveled during the week. It sucked. And so I remember seeing one of my kids' report cards or school things, not report cards. And it says, what does your dad do? And they didn't know. And they just wrote it, shoe salesman.
Wow.
Yeah. So since we're being authentic, like, if my kids ever showed interest in doing this, I would bring them in and nurture them and do it, but not one of them have ever shown any interest. And like, since we're being real, like, I'm not encouraging it. My daughter's in business school at UT. Like, go get a freaking business degree. Like, you have to be passionate about something. And if you're not passionate, I mean, I'll give you a great example. Like, Steve's daughter, passionate and like hardworking. She wants to be a graphic designer, and she's a good young graphic designer. She's got passion. Like, if my kids showed that, then it'd be different. But since they haven't ever shown it, I'm not doing it.
My kids don't care either, but they're a little bit younger. I mean,
they do like seeing the Emmy Awards in the guest room. They like the Emmys.
Who doesn't like seeing that?
Yeah.
Here's the last question. Are you ready? Ready? LeBron versus Jordan.
Jordan. I mean, like, not even close.
What do you mean not even close? So what does that mean?
Here's why. I think that and it's funny. So you talk about kids. So Lucas and I, my youngest, who's 14, he's a huge hoop head. We had this conversation watching the Lakers and the Timberwolves the other night. We talked about this for like a good 15, 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And LeBron is just a little too much of a bully. Like, his game, and I use the example of Karl Malone. Like, there's not as much range in LeBron's game as there was in Jordan's game. Jordan was able to get pounded on, beaten on, come back, be tough, be all of these different things, be a chameleon. When LeBron is pressed, he just puts his shoulder down. I mean, he'll pull up and you know, and he's got a good, you know, he's got a good shot. I mean, like, I would consider LeBron GOAT 2, but I don't think there's a debate on who GOAT 1 is.
All right, Chip Reeves, go enjoy your Saturday. You have been unbelievable with your time, and thank you so much.
Thanks for the time, Chip. This is awesome.
Appreciate it for you having me on.
He's a good guy.
He seems like a really good guy.
He is. He's always fun to be around. He is fun. All right, can I go work on my backyard? Are you going to yell at me more?
I think that's probably it for the time being.